This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Chalmers Johnson, who is president of the Japan Policy Research Institute, a nonprofit research and public affairs organization devoted to public education concerning Japan and international relations in the Pacific. He taught for 30 years, 1962 to 1992, at the Berkeley and San Diego campuses of the University of California, and held endowed chairs in Asian politics at both of them. His most recent books, a trilogy, focus on the American Empire. They are Blowback, The Sorrows of Empire, and now his new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. Chalmers, welcome back to Berkeley.
Well, thank you very much, Harry. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Tell us how you chose that title.
Nemesis is the ancient Greek goddess of revenge, of retribution, the punisher of hubris and arrogance. She's a very important figure in iconography, usually shown as a fierce young woman, usually with scales in one hand and a whip in the other. But she's a very legitimate goddess. She was the sister of Erato, the goddess of love poetry. She's perhaps, for the readers of Edith Hamilton and other Greek mythology books, you will recall, she's the one who found Narcissus in the woods, led him to the pond, showed him his reflection. He fell in love with it, dove in and drowned. But I'm suggesting that Nemesis is present in our country now, waiting for her divine mission.
And your book is really an analysis of the consequences of empire, which you've traced in the previous two books, on the American Republic. And in summary, the chickens have come home to roost.
Yes. I mean, the essential, it's not certainly the only argument, but the essential argument in Nemesis is that there is no more unstable political configuration, history tells us, than the one of the United States today. That is, a domestic democracy combined with a foreign empire. The two don't mix. You can be one, you can be the other, but you don't get to do both. If you try it, it's going to work out one way or the other. You're going to lose your domestic democracy, as, for example, did the Roman Republic, which is significant because so much of our principles in the Constitution were derived from the Roman Republic. Or I suggest in the book there is an alternative. You could, like the British — I'm not a great admirer of the British Empire by any manner of means — but the British Empire after World War II, having just defeated Nazism, it became apparent, I think, to the English that it was not possible to retain the jewel in the crown, India, except short of administrative massacres. Mm-hmm. The British had used them often enough in the past, but it was now no longer acceptable in light of Nazi behavior during World War II. Therefore, I argue, they gave up their empire in order to retain their democracy. And it is something I believe we in this country ought to be talking about very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, if we look at your intellectual odyssey, which we talked about in the last interview, it's quite interesting. As an Asian, as a distinguished Asian scholar, you actually were involved as a consultant to the CIA, commenting on national intelligence estimates.
Yes.
And now, in this book and in a recent article in Harper's, you're trying to write an NIA for the people and the American democracy.
It is illegal to write a national intelligence estimate on the United States. The CIA is not supposed to do intelligence on the United States. Of course, it has on numerous occasions gone ahead and actually done that. That's what I tried to do in the Harper's piece. But it is an NIE is relevant, it seems to be, in that it deals with what the best the intelligence community can do putting together the paths of the future. As I say at the end of the Harper's piece, my wife used to ask me, why is this stuff so highly classified? And I said, well, it's probably highly classified because it's the best we can do, and it would be embarrassing to actually display to the world the best we can do. Our intelligence functions are not very good, despite the original purposes of the Central Intelligence Agency and the way of, and the legislation that created it.
Let's talk a little about the history that one finds throughout the book. You've talked already about the comparison with Rome and Great Britain,
yes.
With the hope of understanding this challenge. And I have a quote here. You say, the problem was that the Roman Constitution made administration of so large and diverse an area increasingly difficult and subtly altered the norms and interests that underlay the need for compromise and consensus.
Precisely. That is to say, to look at the United States today, the president goes around saying, I am the decider. It's hard to think of a more absurd remark and more hostile to our Constitution. He's anything but the decider. It's to be done by consensus through the separation of powers, things of this. This is, of course, what is breaking down. It goes back to probably the most important piece of advice ever given to us by a former president. I would certainly include Eisenhower, but it's the original one. It's George Washington's farewell address that is read to the opening session of Congress each due term, in which he said, the great enemy of liberty is standing armies and the particular enemy of Republican liberty. What he meant by it is that, of course, standing armies, as distinct from raising an army to defend the country in a time of national emergency, that standing armies draw power to Washington, destroy federalism, increase the power of the presidency, increase secrecy in government, draw funds from throughout the country into the military. In a certain sense, Eisenhower's warning in 1961, which he used the phrase and invented it, military-industrial complex, was a further manifestation of this warning that the intervening variable, but to sound social sciencey, the intervening variable between domestic democracy and foreign imperialism is militarism. To have an empire, and let's always remember, an empire is a pure form of tyranny. It never rules through consent. It rules through military force, even though the British and the Americans love to say to themselves, they have a pocket industry of writing books about how foreigners love us. But you don't rule through consent in any way, shape, or form. In order to create the empire, to protect it, to expand it, you need armed forces. The most common picture in our minds of American troops in Iraq. A burly fellow with half a dozen other well-fed Americans standing there kicking down the door of a private home, rushing in with an assault rifle, pointing at it, at cowering women and hollering democracy in a language that nobody in the room understands. I think this is where the issue comes up, that you can't, as militarism is an inescapable accompaniment of imperialism. And the militarism will force changes domestically. This was what the British, I think, did realize in 1945. To keep India, they would have to become a domestic tyranny. They would have to change their own government, and the public would not stand for administrative massacres, and that therefore the choice was stark. They also were fortunate in one sense. They know that they could piggyback on the backs of American power at the time, so that it was somewhat easier.
But their leaders had the courage to make this decision.
Right. Now, not done perfectly. There were many fallbacks, many atavistic responses, including the god-awful war against the Kikuyu in Kenya in the 1950s, the Anglo-French-Israeli attack on Egypt in 1956. You could certainly mention today, speaking of atavisms, Tony Blair, and of all the places you would have thought any halfway intelligent English prime minister would not get involved in was Iraq, which they had already bungled in creating after the First World War and were the first people to really use poison gas in Mesopotamia. There they are.
Back
at a bad mistake.
Yeah. As one looks at your analysis of the empire, and we're going to get back to this Harper's article in a few minutes, you give us a compelling analysis of where America is today.
Yes,
and
I hope so.
Just reading some of the chapter titles, Militarism and the Breakdown of Constitutional Government, the CIA, the President's Private Army, U.S. Military Bases and Other People's Country, How Empire Works, the Status of Force Agreement in Japan, and so on.
Yes.
What is striking, I think, is your accounts of these aspects of American empire really trace a history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So at the one at one level, you're saying things have really gotten bad recently.
Yes.
But this is an evolution. So history becomes important in a second sense.
Yes. I'm not in any way saying that this is all Bush administration.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no doubt that they have done disastrously stupid things and made it worse. In another sense, I would argue if you were a serious, committed American imperialist, you'd have liked Bill Clinton better than George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
He was more subtle. He tried to disguise what he was doing, called it globalization, ineluctable forces, technological change, the market made me do it sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the case of George Bush, he, along with the neoconservatives, simply dropped the mask, said we are the new Rome, we have full spectrum dominance, we can enforce our will through military power. That immediately sets up the realization that they're coming. What it might take to resist the Americans. It might take nuclear weapons. That certainly crossed the minds of some people in Tehran and Pyongyang.
So looking at this leap that has made our foreign policy, are we looking at a Schumpeterian atavism, basically a group that whose leadership at one time made sense at the end of the Second World War, but over time failed to adapt, which is, I know, as I recall, what led you to write your first book, Blowback?
Well, I think that, yes, it's a very complex history. One of the things I'm not sure that I'm the last word on it at all. One of the things I'm trying to do here as a retired professor is open up this territory to make it a little bit safer for young scholars. Political science has almost failed hopelessly. It emits no interesting signal in the world today, and that these things should be being studied. My argument would be our mistakes and the invitation to Nemesis began with the collapse of the Soviet Union. We misanalyzed it. We said that we won the Cold War. The truth of the matter is we both lost it. They lost it first because they were always much poorer, but we're both now suffering from the same kinds of pressures of ideological rigidity, imperial overstretch, inability to reform, even though, give Gorbachev credit, he did try. It's then, it seems to me, that we make the historic errors in the 1990s, and particularly carried on by the so-called neoconservatives, but generally speaking, the American establishment concluded that we were a new Rome. We were the lone superpower. These are hubristic terms, if you ever saw them, that we can rule through military force, that back at the end of the first Bush administration, when Wolfowitz was in the Department of Defense, he already wrote the strategy that said our policy should be to prevent any nation or combination of nations, friend or foe, posing any kind of a military challenge to us. This leads then into defense budgets that are larger than all other defense budgets combined. That's the current state in the United States. Playing with bankruptcy, producing the worst debts in recorded history, and things of this sort.
Mm-hmm. Your analysis really gives us a closed system that showing us how all the parts work.
Well, let me say something further on that. People have often asked me, you were a Cold Warrior, et cetera, et cetera. How did you change your mind? What was the... one of the things that I think is very important here is that When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the thing that struck me most vividly is how our government went to work instantly to find a replacement enemy. The military-industrial complex had to be kept in being. It could be China, it could be drug lords, it could be terrorism, even instability, anything to keep the thing going, which is also relates to what happened in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev did certainly conclude he'd rather have friendly relations with Germany and France than these crummy satellites that were left over from Stalin's imperialism in Eastern Europe. He tried it. He ran into vested interests that he could not surmount. I believe the same is true today. I cannot think of any president in any party who could truly stand up to the military-industrial complex. It's now so deeply embedded in our own society as a way of providing jobs for Americans, or to the Central Intelligence Agency.
One of the points that you emphasize in this book and in the Harper's article is the importance of what you're talking about now, and you call it military Keynesianism.
Yes.
And what we've
That's
done...
That's not my phrase, actually. It goes back to a Polish economist during World War II who invented the phrase to explain the first German economic miracle, that is Hitler's elimination of depressed conditions in Germany through armaments expenditures. It does obviously mean pump priming, but not in truly in the Keynesian sense. There's no counter-cyclical aspect to it. There is, in fact, once you start using the military budget to provide jobs, you develop a vicious cycle that leads to wars, and wars lead to more armament spending, and the thing. You never
and you can't turn
back.
Off the spigot.
You never cut back.
Yeah. So that and this because the empire of bases, which you talked about in the second book, is the muscles of the empire, which go out in the world and behave in the way you discovered they behaved in Okinawa when you helped write that report.
Yeah.
But what the new element here, I mean, it's not an idea that's necessarily original with you, but you are applying it to this context, which is to say, hey, there's a bigger issue here, and when we add to military Keynesianism privatization, then you've got a whole new set of problems that you can't change.
The thing really begins to get badly out of control.
Yeah.
Let me stress here that there are still many Americans who have trouble with the idea that we are that it's an empire, that we are imperialist, and I think it's worth emphasizing that, of course, we recognize British, French, Dutch, Portuguese empires as places that ruled through colonies around the world and often involved a good deal of immigration from the home country. I'm contending that, yes, those were certainly empires, but that's not the only kind. Mm-hmm. That there was another good example of an empire, and that was what the Soviet Union did create in Eastern Europe at the end of World War II. Satellites with foreign troops based either in the country or on the territory, integrated into the economy of the Soviet bloc, and with leaders that were puppets of the Soviet regime. We do that. Our unit of empire is the military base, of which, according to the most recent official count, the base structure report, which is an unclassified Pentagon report, there's 737 of them around the world. Apologists for the Pentagon like to go around saying, oh, well, these are Marine guards in embassies. That simply isn't true. There aren't that many countries. We certainly do not have 700 embassies around the world. These are genuine military bases, with all of the problems of the local population having to live with healthy young Marines, most of whom have a good deal of racism built into them as Americans, believe that they are divinely appointed to hunt down evildoers, but that lead to endless bar brawls, sexually violent crimes, hit-and-run accidents, environmental pollution, noise pollution. Okinawa is a brilliant example. 37 American military bases on an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. 1,300,000 Okinawans living there. The reason for it, of course, is that the Japanese government itself, the Japanese people, probably like the Japanese-American Security Treaty, but they assuredly do not like the thought of having any American troops living anywhere near them. So they dump them in a Japanese equivalent of Puerto Rico, an island that was acquired late in the 19th century by the Japanese Empire. It's always been discriminated against. They couldn't care less in Tokyo how the people of Okinawa feel about having 17,000 Marines of the 3rd Marine Division and the largest American military facility in East Asia, Kadena Air Force Base, plunked down in the middle of their midst.
Mm-hmm. And there's quite an irony here, because earlier you talked about comparing the Clinton administration with the Bush administration, and on the in the liberal side of the debate in our country, the notion of humanitarian intervention, the notion that we will spread democracy and our ideals. But what you're suggesting is that the underside of these military, the status of force agreements all over the world, create a situation where rules are in place that make our soldiers able to act outside of the law.
Absolutely.
And create really a kind of delegitimizing of American power. So even at the same time that the Japanese may want our security umbrella, the people and the mayors are really up in arms about their young women being raped or American soldiers being outside the law when they commit a murder.
And they're expensive. These bases are it's an entirely separate budget from the defense appropriation. It's called the defense facilities appropriation. Mm-hmm. It's the two mother hens of this subcommittee on the Senate Armed Services Committee are Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Dianne Feinstein of California, mm-hmm. the states with the largest number of military bases, of which they're extremely protective and pay attention to also what is spent around the world on military bases. But of course, our troops have privileges that are very similar to those of the former Soviet troops located in East Germany before the wall came down. They were living better in Germany, certainly, than they would have lived back in Russia. Our Marines are living better in Okinawa than they would live in a rather crummy stateside town like Oceanside, California, next door to Camp Pendleton. I know, since I live in northern San Diego County. The costs are very, very high, and Americans have no appreciation of it whatsoever, because we have no foreign military bases in the United States. Mm-hmm. You can also be absolutely certain Americans would not tolerate it one hour of the sort of things that are simply routine in Aviano Air Base in northern Italy, where, if you've seen it just this past month, we've had major demonstrations against the enlargement of a base in Vicenza. No, Vicenza is the old Palladian city for the most famous architecture on Earth. You could well imagine that people don't like the idea of enlarging the base more. That's one of the places they store cluster bombs and things like that. None of it's attractive.
Mm-hmm. As I was taking notes on your book and was thinking about in preparation for the interview, it sort of struck me that the way Americans deceive themselves about what they're doing is the extent to which these actions, especially abroad, are encapsulated.
Yes.
That we tend to see, if we think of the bases, we think protection of the peoples of the world. We think the McDonald's and the Burger Kings that we've put there, and this is spreading.
And there are great economic incentives.
Right. But what you're suggesting is that in many ways the encapsulation, the walls burst. Basically, among the local populations, and now under President Bush, in examples like the renditions, which have become more intense.
Yes.
So that, but what you're basically saying is, you can't keep these walls up. That what you have is a malignancy. It appears to be benign. It appears to be benign.
Yes.
But what you're saying, when you add these up,
and
you're doing more and more of it, that it really turns malignant, and then it metastasizes.
It turns into deceit. I mean, we have huge dumpers of bases in Great Britain. They're mostly disguised as Royal Air Force bases. Mm. It's something that went back to the early Cold War, all done through administrative agreements between our ambassador and British authorities. There are no Englishmen on these bases. Englishmen know this. And they're all over the world. As well as then the history of our interventions. Probably, in my opinion, the most anti-American democracy on earth is probably Greece. They will never forgive us for 5 years of the Greek colonels, the late 60s, early 70s, installed by the CIA, produced an onerous regime until finally the colonels simply went too far themselves. It's the sort of thing that happened on 9/11. My book Blowback had been published a year earlier. On the morning of 9/11, I was chatting with my publisher in New York over what had happened. We're now aware that it was a terrorist incident, but we hadn't yet tumbled to the idea that these were Islamic terrorists, that these were Saudi Arabians. And our first thought was, well, look at the date, September 11th. September 11th, 1973, is the best-known date in Latin America. It's the day the CIA overthrew the elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile and installed probably the most odious dictator on either side in the Cold War, General Augusto Pinochet. So I thought, maybe they're Chileans. They might be from any number of other countries in the southern cone of South America. Maybe they're Okinawans. Maybe they're Greeks. They could be any number of people. Once we start adding, it could be Indonesians. We got rid of Sukarno and put in General Suharto and finally got rid of him when he got on our nerves.
This is a good point to show your book again, Nemesis by Chalmers Johnson, and to point out that in your chapter on militarism, actually think it's the chapter on the president's army, the CIA, you actually help us understand where the Osama bin Laden came from, and it's essentially the funding of the Mujahideen through Pakistan with Saudi money that helps us understand that day.
The largest single clandestine operation we ever carried out was recruiting, arming, training, sending in a battle of the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Osama bin Laden was without question an asset, an ally, just the sort of man you would have expected to meet if you were a house guest at Kennebunkport under the first George Bush.
At least the father.
He's a wealthy, pious young Saudi from a very wealthy family and who was outraged by just being dumped after the Soviet Union withdrew in 1988 we had no interest at all in the fact that Afghanistan would descend into one of the most pitiless civil wars in modern times, in which it got so bad that you would welcome the Taliban finally to bring it to an end. And that then, when the retaliation finally did genuinely come on 9/11, it's certainly not the first. I mean, bin Laden had attacked us in 1973. He'd attacked our barracks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. He'd attacked two embassies in East Africa, the USS Cole in the port of Aden, and then finally 9/11. But then we come up with this nonsense about this is a clash of civilizations, that he dislikes our way of life, our democracy. The president is posing these faux questions about why do they hate us. The truth of the matter is, a week after 9/11, bin Laden published in all the press of the world his stated reasons for why we did it. I mean, why we carried out what the Defense Department called an act of asymmetric warfare. One was, you people placed American troops in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War. That wasn't necessary. We do not believe that the House of Fahd needed to be defended by infidel troops, particularly since they are charged with defending the two most sacred sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Secondly, he said, you Americans will never know peace so long as you continue to support one-sidedly the Israelis in their aggression against the Palestinian people and their land. And third, he accused us of something that we now all acknowledge, that during the most vigorous sanctions ever enforced in the 1990s by Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright, that we killed 500,000 Iraqi children in the process. We starved them. They died of disease. We prohibited the importation of things that would produce clean water, things of this sort. I cite these not because I agree with them, but these are genuine causes belli. These are not abstract statements of this is a clash of medieval Islam versus modern America. These are genuine grievances, and it's a way of catching our attention. Well, He certainly did that. We then made a bad mistake of making the situation worse by declaring a war on terrorism, refusing to follow our procedures for people who commit crimes against innocent bystanders. It would not have been terribly difficult for us to have gone after the whole Al-Qaeda bunch, arrested them, brought them, extradited them, brought them back to the United States, tried them in American courts, found them guilty, and executed them. That's what we should have done, and we should never should have called it a war. An emergency would have been a better term.
I just want to underline a point that you made in passing, which is the consequences of the militarism at home and the acts of our armies,
yes,
our secret armies abroad, and two particular things that you discuss in the book is the way we dealt with the cultural artifacts of Iraq after the invasion, and then you just mentioned the sanctions in the 90s under Bill Clinton and the consequences for children there, actually. So in other words, that as a result of this dependence on military behavior,
yes,
and on the empire of bases as an instrument, if the primary instrument out of our power, we wind up taking actions that if you did a vote among the American people, they would say, well, this is incompatible with what we stand for.
If you think that the president now spends a lot of time talking about our promotion of democracy. To turn that over to the military is insane. You're not going to promote democracy through people kicking down doors and behaving the way our military does. They're not trained to do that. They're not any good at it. They're counterproductive. It seems to be no question that the Iraqi people will hate us till the end of time, they didn't ask for this, and that moreover, to have had such stupid militarists, that is, that it turns out the war is 2 years old before the president is actually informed about the difference between Sunni and Shia Islam, and that the regime that he just overthrew was a minority Sunni government that had dominated the mass of the Shia population in Iraq, and that once you overthrew him, guess what? These people are going to come to power, and they're going to ally themselves with their Shia neighbor, the Shia superpower, Iran, and that this is not going to be to your advantage, to Israel's advantage, or any of the other pipe dreams come up with by amateurs sitting in extremely conservative and right-wing think tanks paid for by American billionaires in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. You actually, talk about, you call it something, it's not stupidity, but the extent to which... Well, it is stupidity, but there is a...
When we're told that the army had... At the time of the invasion, we had four people in the army who spoke Arabic.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that's stupid. When you think back to the days of the attack on the war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We trained a huge cadre of extremely distinguished Japanese linguists at Boulder, at the University of Michigan, mm-hmm, things of this sort. We don't seem capable of doing that at all anymore.
So, but you were citing the arguments of Hannah Arendt and the whole question of just thinking, that part of morality is just being able to look at problems and think rationally about them and draw on the kinds of training and expertise that must exist in the government.
Yes, maybe I ought to say a word about that, simply because I do use one of Arendt's arguments, and it is always dangerous, I believe, in our society to ever compare anything to the Nazis. But in her famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, the trial of Adolf Eichmann that she covered, she ended the book with this now famous line so is illustrated the banality of evil.
Mm-hmm.
She then went out of her way later to say that she didn't really mean anything by that except that he was a desk murderer.
Mm-hmm.
He was remote from the crime itself.
Mm-hmm.
That he was indifferent to it. He was a technician supplying transportation to the death camps. That rather famously in the book, Eichmann has revealed himself to be well-educated and claims to be a devout man. Judge Landau, presiding over the court, said in that case, explained to us the meaning of Kant's categorical imperative. And Arendt argues, I never heard it better expressed. There was no doubt that he knew exactly what Immanuel Kant was getting at here. But she said he had forgotten how to think.
Mm-hmm.
He no longer, now that this was relevant to me, I mean, he had no conscience. He was unable to put things in context. Abu Ghraib, we come now to Americans who are torturing prisoners mm-hmm. in extremely grotesque manner and photographing and laughing about it. The E-ring of the Pentagon had signs, posters putting up of the enlisted men that have subsequently been and women who have been convicted, that these are the six morons who lost the war. I, in my first chapter, expand this to seven morons and start with the president and go down to General Myers and a few others of that
Donald
sort.
Donald Rumsfeld, I hope.
Certainly Donald figures there.
Yeah.
But it is to say, one of the people I had in mind was Sergeant Darby, who was also in these cell blocks in Abu Ghraib, who got one of the computer disks with photographs of people in grotesque positions and being tortured. And he looked at it and said, this is contrary to everything I believe in, mm-hmm. contrary to everything the U.S. Army stands for. And he delivered it to Army Criminal Investigation. And that's the way it started, led on to General Takubo's report and things of this sort. I said, well, even though he has been pilloried by many professional militarists in this country, General Darby was an American who had not forgotten how to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting because in the end, you're somewhat pessimistic about the
subtitle, I mean it.
Yeah, yeah. The last days of the American Republic. But this example... one must believe that there's a broader group of people in the military
yes.
who essentially are concerned about the violation of international law and so on. In the book, strangely enough, it's an entirely different thing, but you do an aside there on the plane spotters, which you were president of a plane spotting association
right.
in the United States, so this is something you know and do. And these were people who basically watch planes, and they became key to our understanding of the renditions and all these secret planes.
Well, rendition is kept totally secret. I mean, that is this world of abducting people off the streets of Milan or Stockholm or wherever it might be, flying them off to a detention center that we know about mm-hmm. or one of our own in a foreign mm-hmm. country where they will unquestionably be tortured. One of our main CIA officials in the Middle East had said, if you want just a good, hard torture interrogation, you send him to Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
If you want him to just disappear, you send him to Egypt. And that's what we do with it. Well, nobody knew anything about this. It was as mm-hmm. under wraps as could be. And you should understand, these are not foreign captures of American fugitives to be returned to American justice. This is instead a clandestine activity carried out by the Department of Operations within the CIA. The CIA made some monumental blunders in the things they were doing, one of which they did these flights around the world via civil aviation, apparently not understanding mm-hmm. that there is no place with more eyes awake 24 hours a day than any international airport,
mm-hmm.
just hundreds of people that are watching things. Among the people watching, which is the way the case began to be broken, were something called airplane spotters. They go back to World War II, to the Blitz in Britain. There was a very famous magazine published with official sanction by the Temple Press called the Aeroplane Spotter that is still regarded as one of the great sources of all time, on the Luftwaffe, on the 8th Air Force, on the Royal Air Force. What we're looking at here is airplane types, obviously, but then you begin to look at registrations, at squadron markings, at serial numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You start putting this stuff together. Once you get a database, you could infer the number of a particular type, things of this sort. So that it's now getting harder and harder to do, but because runways are not quite as accessible as they once were. Though the new Japanese Olympus camera has a lens that goes perfectly through a chain link fence.
So
you stand out at the end of runways with binoculars and cameras and photographing airplanes landing, watching them going around, and a group of spotters at Shannon Airport in Ireland, called the Shannon Peace Campers, outed one of the first planes flying people to Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. And then you started tracing that down. It's easy once you've got the registration numbers to, it's all on the internet, to start finding out who allegedly owns this, and discovered that it's owned by a company that has no employees, that the addresses are all post office boxes in Northern Virginia near mm-hmm. Langley, that the officers of the company are clearly fake, that they are men who have Social Security cards that were issued when they were in their 50s. This is an almost certain sign of a new identity being created. Mm-hmm. And that the moment one gets outed, the registration changes overnight. That's the way it started. Then some other smart journalists picked it up, and finally it ended up, you know, this huge scandal of the spies who came in from the hot tub. They discovered that the 25 CIA agents are now under indictment in Italy for pinching this this imam off the streets of Milan, mm-hmm. flying him to Ramstein Air Base, then off to Cairo, where he was unquestionably tortured. And these were felonies committed mm-hmm. On Italian territory. But it was then revealed that our 25 spies that were carrying out this operation were staying in the Principe di Savoia Hotel in Milan at $500 a night, that they ran up bills of $150,000 for just hotel rooms. Then they went for vacations on the Tuscan coast and to Venice afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the CIA station chief in Milan had already bought a house to retire in Asti, lovely part of the world.
So the corruption that's part of the
But there
is, in both the case of the sergeant in Abu Ghraib and these plane spotters, there is an inkling of hope here, you know, in the sense that civil society or the way civil society has impacted soldiers who go into them, they have a different set of values because it's a very pessimistic view, which isn't an argument against what you're saying, but one is left without much hope because, as you point out, the other elements of this domestic configuration that helps us break out of this encapsulation is this movement toward implementation of a unitary president by Bush.
Much greater secrecy than in any previous regime.
And then a failure of the checks and balance system on
That's what's breaking down. I mean, we have an imperial presidency that is just out of control today. I still think that it's a much bigger issue, not Bush and Cheney and their sort of crazy ambitions. Presidents often have done things like this. It's what happened to Congress. Why did they fail so badly? Why did they not even attempt oversight? They just gave up on it. Mm-hmm. And this then made it easy for the president to classify so much stuff that the idea of oversight by a citizen turns out to be absurd. Remember, 40% of the defense budget is black. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets to see it. All of the CIA's budget is black, always has been. It's subject, until the Church Committee in the 1970s, it had no form of oversight whatsoever. It was the president's private army. Mm-hmm. And even though it was created as an intelligence agency, it has in fact evolved irreversibly into an agency of dirty tricks, of overthrowing foreign governments, assassinations, renditions, teaching Latin American military mm-hmm. officers state terrorism, devices to undercut economies that irritate us. No president, the day after he's inaugurated and the director of Central Intelligence comes in and tells him about the power he's got, has failed to use it. It's mm-hmm. a secret army at his orders. It's the Praetorian Guards again.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say, the checks and balances broke down. I want to read a quote that you have from Brandeis.
Well, let me just say that it's important to stress that we know what we should do. Mm-hmm. It's to restore constitutional government.
Right.
But that's so difficult to do. Mm-hmm. That is to say, if you do believe, though, that the government in Washington today bears any resemblance to the one outlined in the Constitution mm-hmm. of 1787, the burden of proof is on you. Mm-hmm. It just simply is not the case. But the Constitution doesn't talk about those two big buildings on the south bank of the Potomac River, the CIA and the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. But this actually is to the point, because you quote Brandeis, which gives a very nice flavor of what our system of government is about, which you're talking about. Brandeis, in the 1926 dissent in Myers versus U.S., said, "The doctrine of the separation of powers was adopted by the Convention of 1787 not to promote efficiency, but to preclude the exercise of arbitrary power.
Absolutely.
The purpose was not to avoid friction, but by means of the inevitable friction incident to the distribution of the governmental powers among three departments to save the people from autocracy." So why has it failed?
Many things, and that's why probably the political system has failed us, and it couldn't be fixed. It's very hard to imagine any president in either party that could stand up to the military-industrial complex or the CIA or whatever. That we have effective constitutional procedures for dealing with an unsatisfactory president. We can impeach him. I mean, for one who lies to the country into war, who violates the law on secrecy and the Fourth Amendment, right to privacy, and things of this sort. Numerous other cases. Last November, the public, again, in an inchoate manner, not well informed, a press that is failing us daily, universities that do nothing except promote each other, that we elect the opposition party. On virtually the day they come to power, the leader of the opposition party says impeachment is off the table. Well, if impeachment is off the table, then maybe democracy is off the table. It's just a way of saying you're acknowledging it doesn't work. But what led to this? It was certainly standing armies. It was militarism. Mm-hmm. It was growing. The military-industrial complex is very clever in that they got a big project like the B-2 bomber. They put a piece of that in as many constituencies as you can possibly find to make sure that if a congressman or woman decided we don't need another weapon of mass destruction, they can be voted out of office next time on simply loss of jobs. It's perfectly logical for the Secretary of Defense to try and close redundant and useless defense facilities, some of them going back to the Civil War and even earlier. Just try it. Every time he does try it, communities erupt. Preachers preach sermons. Newspapers write editorials. People protest. Save our base. Save our job. I come from the 50th District of California. One of our most distinguished citizens, former Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham, is spending 8.5 years in a federal penitentiary for being the largest bribe taker in the history of Congress. It is significant that he was taking bribes from military contractors to buy junk that nobody wanted. The Defense Department didn't want it. It was worthless stuff, while also parading himself around as a Vietnam War Navy air ace and a friend of the military, blah, blah, blah. The 50th District has now gone ahead and elected to replace him a lobbyist working with Abramoff, who's just a little bit smarter than Randy Duke. But it's illustrative of the world that we live in. Well before Cunningham was identified and brought to justice by the U.S. Attorney, I had written an article in the L.A. Times pointing out that he was bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And I received letters from people in, say, the 34th District, downtown Los Angeles, saying, God, I wish he was my congressman. I could use a good job. I wouldn't mind making cluster bombs for use on Lebanese civilians or whatever else. We don't manufacture that much in this country anymore, but we do manufacture more weapons than anybody else on earth.
As a student of Asian political economy, you wrote the classic on Mitty. In the final analysis, your judgment is that not only will we suffer political but also economic bankruptcy.
Well, my wife keeps saying to me, "Come up with something optimistic, will you?" I mean, there's got to be. I mean, it is possible the military could take over. That's the way the Roman Republic ended, that finally vested interests in the military become so great that after the assassination of Julius Caesar, Octavian becomes dictator for life and the god Augustus Caesar. That could happen, and General Tommy Franks, who was the leader of the assault on Baghdad, has already said in print that another attack comparable to 9/11, we in the military probably have no choice but to take over. We're the only ones who know how to run things, blah, blah, blah. You could imagine a renaissance from below. I find that with the third book of this inadvertent trilogy, I'm getting a much better public reaction, suggesting that the public is much more worried than they were when the first two books came out, and that there is a real sense of what do we do, or prepare your escape route. Got any good ideas in Vancouver, Malaga, where should we go, et cetera, et cetera. So it is conceivable, but I think unlikely, given a country this large, how difficult it would be to mobilize it. How
a political movement.
A political movement. I mean, indeed, it's possible. We did it in the civil rights movement, things of this sort. But at the same time, the media are so awful, so clearly owned by conglomerates who are making money off of advertising, that Rupert Murdoch talks about buying a third of the Los Angeles Times, things of this sort, that it's almost impossible to imagine the citizen playing the citizen's role as Benjamin Franklin imagined it, doing elementary oversight on his government. So what do I suggest probably will happen? I think we will stagger along under a facade of constitutional government, as we are now, until we're overcome by bankruptcy. We are not paying our way. We're financing it off of huge loans coming daily from our two leading creditors, Japan and China.
Both of whom hold about $800 billion.
Exactly. And have no reason to do that forever. It's a rigged system that reminds you of Herb Stein, when he was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in a Republican administration, rather famously said, things that can't go on forever don't. That's what we're talking about today, is we're massively indebted. We're not manufacturing as much as we used to. We maintain our lifestyle off of huge capital imports from countries that don't mind taking a short, small beating on the exchange rates, so long as they can continue to develop their own economies and supply Americans. This means above all China, which without question within 20, 25 years will be both the world's largest social system and the world's most productive social system, It's barring truly unforeseen developments. Bankruptcy would not mean the literal end of the United States any more than it did for Germany in 1923 or China in 1948 or Argentina just a few years ago in 2001 and 2. But it would certainly mean a catastrophic recession, the collapse of our stock exchange, the end of our level of living, and a vast series of new attitudes that would now be appropriate to a much poorer country. Marshall Auerbach is a financial analyst whom I admire, who refers to the United States as a Blanche DuBois economy. Blanche DuBois, of course, was the leading character in Tennessee Williams' play, A Streetcar Named Desire. And she said, I'm dependent upon the kindness of strangers. But we're also increasingly dependent on the kindness of strangers, and they are not many of them left that much care any more than they were for Blanche. I figure if the United States did start to go down, it would not elicit any more tears than the collapse of the Soviet Union did in the world at large today.
Well, do you see a configuration of power external, Japan, China, the EU, that will be a balancer that might not just confront us, but might help guide us to changes that would be good for us and them?
Once you go down the path of empire, you inevitably start a process of overstretch, of you can't stop, of tendencies toward bankruptcy. And certainly in the rest of the world, the tendency toward the unity of people who are opposed to your imperialism, on simply on grounds that it's yours, but it may also be on the grounds that you're incompetent at it. There was one time when the world did trust the United States a good deal as a result of the Marshall Plan, of foreign aid, things of this sort. They probably, very likely, trusted it more than they should have. Today, that is almost entirely dissipated by the current government that's been in power since the Supreme Court appointed it in 2000. It will, at some point, either we will stop it, we will reduce our empire of bases from 737 to maybe 37. I'd just as soon get rid of all of them, but you can make the case. We could probably do it with 37. We don't certainly need 737. If we don't start doing that, then we will go the way of the former Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, one final question, if audience watching the program. Besides reading your three books, which we've convinced them of, how would you advise them if they are concerned citizens with a conscience? You know, what do you see something that just the public can get a handle on to assist the process of changing America back to the way it was?
The political system isn't working very well, but it does depend on an active, engaged citizenry that would at least aspire to doing oversight of its government and discovering how deeply frustrated they're going to be if they try to use the Freedom of Information Act, if they should actually try to account for what is called the defense budget. It's so complex that it's intentionally designed to make sure that you can't really find out the huge amounts that are being spent on the name generally of the military establishment. They could try to become better informed. Start using the internet. I begin the morning every day with not the New York Times, but with antiwar.com. It's not a leftist channel. They're libertarians. Mm-hmm. But it's a good digest of all the news that isn't in the New York Times around the world. And it's a way to begin. And then attempting to put pressure on our government. I don't think this is going to work. I don't think we have enough time. I think we've waited too long, and that we are probably talking about the short, happy life of the American Republic. In that case, you'd have to say to the well-informed citizen would start thinking of his or her escape route. The condo in Vancouver, or whatever else it may be. People keep pushing me on this. I'm 75 years old and say, I'm probably going to write it out. But having been pushed, I said, I happen to have a geriatric Russian blue cat that I admire a great deal. I even mentioned it at the end of the book.
Whose name is?
Moff.
Moff. Let's give her name.
Yeah. It's he.
Sorry.
I did a little quick survey to find out if there's any country on earth that you can get into without putting your cat in quarantine. It turns out the Spaniards don't care. So it looks like Malaga would be a place that would serve.
Chalmers, on that lighter note, I want to thank you very much for writing this trilogy. I want to show the book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. And I want to thank you very much for coming back to Berkeley and being on our program.
I'm indebted to you, and I'm an admirer of Conversations with History. You've done a terrific job with this program.
Thank you very much, Chalmers. And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.